And join me in welcoming our 15-minute speaker, Brian M. from Los Osos.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Lucas. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. It's a true honor to be asked to participate in any sort of sobriety these days more than ever. Let's see, I'll start. I have a sobriety date, 2/28/2008. I wear it around my neck, and Joe's clapping because he's also right there in the 2008 club. You know, we're 13 years into this thing, and I could say that, I was out from the age of, I started drinking when I was 10. I drank till I was 40. So I don't know, I'm not into numerology, but all the like 2/28/2008, I drank from 10 to 40. Felt like I made the whole mess of the thing really, you know, organized at least somehow, that I could remember the numbers of what was going on. I was born down in San Diego, and I was born on a sand-floored surf shack, Mission Beach. Mom and dad were going to San Diego State, and we lived in a place called the Museum that had these black light posters on the walls. And, that was my first days on this planet. My dad would tell me that the next door neighbor would catch cockroaches, and they'd paint them with fluorescent paint, and they'd turn off the lights and then turn on the black lights and watch these bugs scamper around on the ceilings and walls. So, you know, from the very beginning, it was kind of an odd upbringing. My mom hitchhiked away with me to San Francisco, and we lived down at Haight-Ashbury for a little bit, 60s, late, you know, the summer of love, 67, I was born, so right there. And then we ended up, my mom remarried a guy who ran the music store in San Francisco. So my life, as I started to have my first memories, bands like Journey, Santana, The Grateful Dead, Steve Miller, were all in my living room, and not just on vinyl. They were there nightly themselves, partying with my parents. My mom was Miss Annie Greenspring Wine. So for the Jurassic folks in the room, the folks who've been around a long time, for Miss Annie Greenspring Wine, my mom was like the spokesmodel or whatever for the wine. Is like a bad wine. You brought the red and the white to the party. You showed up with both. And my dad, you know, being a musician, my stepdad, and hanging out with all these folks, I watched them on a nightly basis. We weren't left with the babysitter. We were invited to all the parties as a kid. You go to the parties with your parents in your pajamas, and everyone would play music no matter where you were in that kind of Marin hot tub scene. And it looked like chaos to me, and it looked really, really fun. I won't deny that I just wanted exactly what my parents were doing. I wanted to do what they were doing as soon as possible. I do remember like passing a bottle or making drinks for people or passing a joint when they're all playing music in a circle. And I remember, when I was only single digits going, I could take a hit off that joint, or I could drink and my parents would be okay with that. But I thought I'd wait. So I remember waiting till I was 10 years old and feeling like I'd honestly like waited. And, I have children now, and I just, I have an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old. The 11-year-old's in the other room watching my 6-year-old right now in the other room. And I just couldn't imagine, my 11-year-old, what I was doing at 10. It kind of breaks my heart thinking about little me, what was going on there. Fast forward a few years, I started partying. By the time I got to senior year of high school, I threw my senior kegs. I went off to Washington State University in Eastern Washington because we moved from Marin County up to Seattle. My dad opened up a music store in Seattle called American Music. Some of those bands actually followed up there, like Steve Miller, I remember Sly and the Family Stone and Journey being at the house a lot up in Seattle. And Sly was crazy, and he's publicly one of us, so I feel like I could out him, even though he's still around a little bit there. But I went off to Washington State University, and Penthouse magazine used to rate the top party schools. And San Jose and Chico and San Diego State, and those schools would always be the top one, two, three on the list. But Washington State was always at the bottom of it. And it said, Washington State University, we don't rank the pros with the rookies. And, you could wheel a keg into the football games with your ticket. And that was okay. You could bring a whole keg of beer at 18 years old to the football game and nobody would question it. There's two bars on campus. And I had tabs at both the Coug and the Cavern, and you could stop between classes and get a pitcher of beer before going to your next class. And I was in heaven. I thought that was the greatest thing ever. I threw a party called Green Stock out there. It was a 3-day music festival. I brought all these bands from Seattle and had bands play every hour on the hour from Friday at 4 in the afternoon till Monday at 4 o'clock in the morning, nonstop, round the clock. It was a party I threw for like 6 years, and it was, up until getting sober, it was my 15 minutes of fame. It's something I really just was so proud of that I was able to pull off these crazy huge parties where we'd stay up for 3 days straight. And I had like 35,000 people show up to the biggest one. It was declared a national disaster in the state of Idaho. So I even have a national disaster under my belt from a party I threw. I thought that was kind of fun, or at least a good story to tell for a while. I moved back to Seattle and I started managing bands and hanging out at the Off Ramp and the Rock Candy, these two bars down the bottom of Capitol Hill in Seattle. If anyone's familiar with it, everyone drank alcoholically. I started bartending and working there on my off nights from booking shows and managing bands, and just poured keg cups full of, just solid booze and a splash of soda on the top. And everybody would stay drunk till having hash after the bash at the end of the night. And I didn't know it at that time, but I was, right in the middle of what was happening in that grunge scene. So, I'm hanging out with the guys from Soundgarden, and I'm managing like Chris Cornell's siblings band, and I'm, Kurt's getting too drunk at the bar and I'm throwing him out of the off ramp, and all those guys are there and they're all doing heavier drugs than I was. I was going to the same parties, but I wasn't doing the things that they're doing. And, so I felt like I was okay, even though I was drinking 6 days a week, starting to black out more and more often. But I could say that by that time, I definitely started to feel this big, empty, hollow feeling in the middle of my chest. I just was never complete. If I wasn't drinking, I felt, I didn't fit in. I was lonely. I remember like even taking a day or two off from partying and just feeling like those days were endless. Then fast forward, I ended up really just in my pure alcoholism. I met a billionaire. I asked him for $5 million drunk, and he gave it to me. And that sounds like a lot of people would say that's a fun story or an exciting thing, but to an alcoholic, it was kind of probably the worst thing and maybe the best thing that could have happened to me. Now I had my ego was out of control. I hired a lot of people. I got an office in New York and I was flying around the country just drunk all the time. Hurting a lot of people that I loved first and people I didn't know. So I'd wake up pretty much every morning. I started to notice a real routine where I had to apologize to somebody the next day. It was just the way it was. And, I was back in my office and, I'm CEO and founder of my own music video company. I look at the reflection in the glass, looking out at the mountains of the Cascades from my office. And I saw my reflection and the only words I could come up with was, uh-oh, came out of my mouth. And the uh-oh meant, it meant lots of things, but it really meant I was going out that night, even though I didn't want to. And I didn't want to go out. I didn't feel good. And I didn't want to go drink that night, but I knew it would happen for sure. It meant that I really was drinking alcoholically to the point of like suicidal tendencies. I'd go to bed nightly, try to drink enough to not think about suicide. But then that stopped working. The alcohol kind of turned on me and it started, I'd envision like, my bedroom window breaking and terrible things with that glass. I'll stop right there. But I thought I was a big shot. I get in my big hot tub on my back deck And I drank that nightcap, which would be in a 40 ounce cup that I had, this big yellow plastic cup that I'd take into the hot tub. And I'd pour pure, you know, just Jack Daniels, splash of 7-Up. I'd drink it. And then I'd sink down to just my nose level in the hot tub, and I'd try to go to sleep. And that was happening nightly. So looking back on it, you know, that's how, what things were like. What happened is I was married to my first wife at that time. She had a couple boys from her previous marriage. I was raising them, but not present and not being a good dad. I was not there. And when I was an asshole. I had a marriage counselor who said, Brian, I think maybe you should come see me without your significant other, and we should have some time, alone time. I was like, well, you're a marriage counselor. Why do we need alone time? And she took about a year to convince me that I was alcoholic. I knew I was alcoholic. I toasted to be an alcoholic. I hung out with alcoholics. I didn't hide it. I you know, toasted it in the bar. But she called me once when I was down in LA and in the morning, and I was having DTs that were really severe. I was bouncing out of the bed in the hotel room. I wasn't going to go to the meetings I was scheduled to go to. And I was violently sick and ill. And she called and said, I'm just calling to check in on you. I was wondering if you're doing okay today. I just had a bad feeling. And I said, I'm not doing good. And she said, well, when you come back to Seattle, will you go to one of those AA meetings? And I'm like, sure. The first meeting I went to was, I just picked one out of a directory. And there's three people there. The lead didn't show up. Everybody's in gowns. It was an inpatient facility that I drove to. Everybody had one day sobriety, more than me. They all were in their first day. I was in my first hour. And that was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't hear a lot. Went to another meeting that night called 59 Minutes at Pine Lake. And I heard my story. I found my first fellowship. I jumped right in. That moment, I knew I was going to be okay. I went straight to Pink Cloud and just feeling like this is where I belong. I don't want to drink anymore, even if I want to, and I'm going to circle myself in this group. And I did for 90 meetings in 90 days. I then ran off to rehab because that same marriage counselor said, hey, the train is still crashing, Brian. You still got a lot of problems around you that are driven by your alcoholism. Even if you're not drinking, you're not sober. And I wanted to avoid rehab, but maybe you should go. So I went to a 2-month inpatient facility in Canada called Edgewood. Look, I've heard a lot of people knock rehab. Some people like it, some people don't. I think if you find a rehab facility that's based on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a lot of value to a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week AA meeting for an alcoholic like me. You know, I understood my illness. I left that facility knowing that I was sick, that I had a lot of work to do, that the steps were the way to do that work, and that I got reacquainted with my higher power that I call God in that facility. So I was able to, you know, leave there, got the divorce papers when I left, and, you know, started over, moved to Los Osos, California after a few years of sobriety. I had 3 years of sobriety. I moved down to Los Osos. I found the Pioneer Group down at the train station, the old Alano Club. And then I found Melody, which I call my home group, and Harmony. You know, I'm hoping that Melody and Harmony find a way to become Melody Harmony again someday. You know, I look forward to those two groups of people that have been my peeps for a long time, being in the same room or, you know, however, again someday. I also have a home group called Open Door in Los Osos. A lot of people refer to it as the greatest meeting in the world. If you haven't found your, my friend there always says, if you haven't found the greatest meeting in the world, what aren't you doing for your meeting, right? So try to find out what you're not doing for that meeting. And if you can find a place to be of service, maybe it'll become your favorite meeting too. This last year has been, hard for all of us, I know, and I'm not unique there, but I was 12 years into sobriety on February 28th of 2020, and that's really when COVID hit. I got the divorce notice from my now wife. I'm still married, but I felt I'd you know, found the love of my life. I had my home group, my meetings. I was doing HDI work and bringing meetings into Kansas Street over there at the jail once a week, and just loving my sobriety, loving my life. So COVID hit, heard that my wife was going to leave me, and my boys just really suffered a lot through this last year. And I could tell you that the suicidal tendencies, the desire to drink again came back. I thought that, you know, I cried myself to sleep for a year, solid year. I cried every day for a year over that year. And I've been a ragdoll. I can tell you the only reason that I didn't drink, and the only reason I'm sitting here getting to share this with you now, is because I picked up those tools. Even when I thought I wasn't listening or paying attention in the meeting, there were tools that I was able to pick up along the way. There was members of this program, the men in the program, that circled around me at times of my darkest hours over the last year, and held me up when I couldn't hold myself up. And you know, now here I am. I'm unemployed. I lost my job couple months ago. So I'm in Zoom court quite often. That hasn't moved a thing. You know, what I could say is that I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, I'm not going to tell the story of the white horse, but I heard someone do a Cliff Note version of it yesterday. And if you haven't heard the white horse story, find someone in the program to do the white horse story, because, you know, whether it's losing my job or my children having a hard time with not being able to go to school right now at all, maybe not even for another year for my boys because of situations that are out of my control. Divorce with someone I was deeply in love with, that I do know that things are going to be okay. And that they're going to be okay if I can remember to put my sobriety first. And if I could remember that this too shall pass, and to let go and let God. And every day when I get into the shower, I'm dropping to my knees and I'm doing the serenity prayer, but I'm also doing a third step prayer. And I'm writing the names on the shower glass door of all the people that I want to think about and pray for and tap a chair for in a way. And that, you know, tap my shower door for, that can maybe find the rooms that are my friends that are still out and drinking and using. So that's my 15 minutes. That's my story in 15. I love each and every one of you. If you're new, just keep coming back and just, you know, know that, you know, it we practice progress, not perfection. That's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Brian. Let's get another round of applause for Brian.